That's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. The Wisconsin Supreme Court heard arguments this week in a case that could shape the future of reproductive rights in the state.
The High Court is weighing whether a 19th century state law should criminalize abortion providers.
The lawsuit filed in 2022 was brought by State Attorney General Josh Call after the U.S. Supreme Court struck down federal abortion protections 2 years ago.
In court, Liberal Justice Jill Karofsky noted to the legal team defending the 1849 law that the law does not include an exception for a pregnant person's health.
I fear that what you are asking this court to do is to sign the death warrants of women and children and pregnant people in this state.
Joining us now to talk about this case and other issues in the state justice department is Wisconsin Attorney General Josh Call. Attorney General Call, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Good morning. Thanks for having me back.
Good morning. Can you just start with a few takeaways from Monday's oral arguments that you took away from that on Monday?
Well, first, we have been working to protect reproductive freedom in Wisconsin since literally days after Roe v. Wade was overturned. And we went about 15 months in Wisconsin where women were denied access to safe and legal abortion in the state. And that had a lot of consequences for people's lives. There were people who had medical care delayed and so weren't able to get the highest quality standard of care. There were also people who went to doctors with planned pregnancies, pregnancies they were excited about, but who instead of being happy were terrified about what might happen if a concern arose that they weren't expecting. Now, fortunately, reproductive freedom has been restored in Wisconsin for now. But sadly, we've continued to see the impacts in other states like Texas, where some people have lost their lives because of delayed care. And I think you saw from the clip you just played that this is a message that the justices have heard as well. There was a lot of good questioning about what this law means. And it makes clear that if this far right extreme interpretation of this 1849 law is imposed, it's going to have devastating health consequences for women in Wisconsin. So I'm hopeful that we will succeed, but we'll see what the court decides.
And your team argued there was an implied repeal of the 1849 law. And I just wonder, how would that work in the legal realm? Can you explain that?
Yeah, we have a few different arguments as to why we believe that pre-Civil War law does not apply currently now that even though that Roe has been overturned. One of the arguments, as you just mentioned, is that the law has been impliedly repealed. There's a whole series of laws that regulate legal abortion in Wisconsin and make clear when you can and when you can't have an abortion in Wisconsin. And our position is that you can't simultaneously have laws that allow for abortion while having a broad abortion ban in place. That would create confusion for people. And when you have that kind of system, the case law supports the conclusion that the old law has been repealed by implication.
Although Sheboygan County's district attorney is arguing the 1985 law didn't legalize abortion and that it can coexist, it can overlap with the 1849 ban. What do you make of that argument?
Well, that's the argument that he's presented. We were successful in a similar but slightly different argument before the circuit court, and I'm optimistic we'll be successful again here. But look, what we need is clarity on state law regarding this issue so that we can make sure that doctors and women who become pregnant know what their rights are and know what they're going to be able to do. That's what we've been seeking throughout this process, in addition to seeking to protect women's ability to access reproductive health care. So I'm hopeful. But I do also think it's important for our legislature to take action. We have a much more evenly divided state legislature than we've had before. And making sure that the legislature takes action to protect access to reproductive freedom in Wisconsin, that's the long-term solution that we need to ensure that reproductive freedom is respected.
Well, I want to ask you about that because what we have protections on the books already. We have the law that prohibits abortion after 20 weeks. What more do you want to see there in the law?
Well, what we have are not protections. We have restrictions on abortion in state law. So I'd like to see some changes made that ensure that people are able to get the reproductive health care they need and that decisions are made between women and their doctors or their spouses or their spiritual advisors, whoever it is that they want to talk to, but not having the government intervene and be making these decisions for women. So making sure For example, that their ability to make their own decision when their health is imperiled is an example of the type of thing I think we need to make sure is there in statute. But I think there's a lot of, you know, there's room for debate. This is obviously a topic that people have very strong feelings about, but let's have that debate. This is an issue that's important to Wisconsinites, and I think having our legislature take that up is critical.
One more quick legal question before we move on. We also have our eye on a lawsuit brought by Planned Parenthood. The lawsuit in comparison to the one you filed, whether the 1849 ban violates abortion rights in the Wisconsin Constitution. I'm just wondering, what impact would these cases have on each other?
Yeah, we'll see ultimately whether the court decides both cases or how it goes about doing that. It's my view that a ban, like some have suggested the 1849 law is, would be unconstitutional under basic rights guaranteed by the Wisconsin Constitution. There's a long line of Wisconsin cases that make clear that infringements on bodily autonomy need to be very carefully scrutinized by courts. And that's consistent with, I think, our basic notions about liberty in this country and in this state. And protecting those rights with a constitutional ruling, I think, would also help ensure that access to safe and legal abortion is protected in Wisconsin.
We're talking with Wisconsin Attorney General Josh Call about the latest issues facing the Justice Department. Let's turn now to the incoming Trump administration and reproductive rights under a Trump administration. How would the State Department of Justice respond to an attempt to restrict abortion rights nationally?
It'll depend on what actions the Trump administration takes. You know, Donald Trump went out of his way late in the campaign to say that he didn't support a national abortion ban and would veto one, in fact. You know, I'm certainly hopeful that that's the approach he would take, but obviously we want to watch what unfolds to see what's passed in Congress and what actions he may take. The other thing that I expect that we will see is action by administrative agencies in the Trump administration to make it more difficult to obtain abortion. There could be a variety of things that they do to restrict access to safe and legal abortion or to restrict doctors' ability to provide accurate healthcare information. And look, we're going to make sure that if those issues arise, that we step up and protect people's ability to get good information from their doctors and protect their ability to get the healthcare that should be available to them based on the science, not based on political decision making.
I want to turn our attention to immigration. President-elect Trump made border security a centerpiece in his campaign. He's pledged to deport millions of people living in the U.S. illegally. Do you anticipate tension between the State Justice Department and federal agents who would be charged with rounding up undocumented immigrants?
This is going to be one of the issues that we watch carefully as the Trump administration starts laying out what policies it will pursue. And as those policies are implemented, you know, we look, the election, I think, was clearly about inflation more than anything else. I think people want to see the cost of goods go down. So we'll see how things unfold with respect to those sorts of issues. Immigration was another key issue. And I think it's clear that voters want to make sure that we have a secure border in place. My hope is that the Trump administration will work to compromise with Democrats. I think we can both work to make the border more secure while also adopting policies that protect people who, for example, came to this country as kids, dreamers, who have only known America for their whole lives. So making sure that we have an approach that is humane, that respects people's constitutional rights, and that is going to ensure that we have an orderly process. You know, that's something I hope we'll see, but if instead there's a process that ignores the constitutional protections and ignores our laws, then we're prepared to take action.
Turning to opioid settlements, last week the State Department of Justice announcing that grocery store chain Kroger will pay nearly $1.4 billion in opioid settlement funds nationwide. Wisconsin set to receive nearly $22 million starting next year. What does the settlement mean for how Kroger and others like it do business?
Well, it means a couple of things. First, throughout my term in office, we have worked to hold any companies that contributed to the opioid epidemic accountable for their actions. I think that's critical both to make sure that something like this doesn't happen again in the future and that companies know that if they are making a profit off of other people's suffering, that they're going to be held to account. but it's also meant that we've been able to bring substantial resources into the state of Wisconsin. So through our work, as well as the work of county and local governments and other states, we've now secured over $780 million, so almost four-fifths of $1 billion that's going to be coming to the state of Wisconsin to combat this epidemic. Some of those funds have, not from this settlement yet, but from other settlements, have begun to go to communities to support efforts to fight the epidemic. And while there are a lot of things that contribute to the trends we see, it's been encouraging to see for the first time in a while, the overdose rates have begun to go down. Now, it's early and there's a lot more work to do, but having additional resources helps combat those efforts. And in addition, hopefully we'll see companies being more responsible in the way they go about selling prescriptions in this case that could cause harm to people.
And very quickly here, more than $780 million in total funding through those settlements through 2038 as a result of the national litigation. What are some productive ways now that you're seeing Wisconsin communities starting to use the settlement funds?
I've had the chance to meet with people who are on the front lines of the effort to fight the opioid epidemic, including people providing peer support counseling, treatment providers, people who work in social services and law enforcement officers. And there are a lot of things that are being done that are having an impact. One is, with the prevalence of fentanyl, having harm reduction measures is really critical because people are overdosing, in some cases without even realizing that they're ingesting fentanyl. So having fentanyl test strips and having Narcan, which these settlement funds have helped to support, is helping to save lives. But also addressing this issue long-term is key. And so working to get people into treatment is critical as well.
Attorney General Call, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Josh Call is Attorney General of Wisconsin. We've been talking about issues in the state Justice Department and earlier a case that could decide the fate of abortion access here in Wisconsin.
Coming up on Wisconsin Today, Project Ujima in Milwaukee helps youth and their families recover from gun violence. The medical director sees a growing need.
We're really good at saving lives, physical lives, right? What Project Ujima does and other projects like it does is it helps heal the remainder of the story.
That's ahead on WPR News. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Gun violence is declining in Wisconsin and nationwide, but a program in Milwaukee that helps young people who are victims of violence is noting an influx of referrals.
Homicides and non-fatal shootings are each down more than 20% compared to the same time last year. That's according to City of Milwaukee crime data.
Project Ujima launched nearly 30 years ago. It aims to help youth and their families recover from gun violence.
Last month, the Everytown Community Safety Fund awarded the project a $100,000 grant to further their work.
To talk about the program, we turn to Dr. Michael Levis, a professor of pediatrics and medical director of Project Ujima at Children's Wisconsin. Dr. Levis, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thank you for having me.
Can you first talk about the name of this project and what does Ujima mean?
Ujima is a Swahili word for the concept of coming together to make things right. Project Ujima is a program that's been around for almost 25 years, based in Children's, Wisconsin. And it's what makes a child eligible is that they're a victim of some sort of violence. Most of the participants have experienced some sort of interpersonal violence, whether that be, you know, physical assault, ranging all the way to, you know, gunshot injuries. And what the program really does is tries to intervene in that cycle of violence and really embrace the youth and their families in programming that lets them know that someone does care, that someone does want to mentor, and that those experiences are not the defining moments of their lives, that they still have bright futures ahead of them.
Well, Dr. Lovis, let's fast forward to present day. Project Ujima receiving a grant from Everytown Community Safety Fund for $100,000. How will this funding be used?
The funding mainly will be used for frontline service. So the way the project works is once you're enrolled with the project, every youth and family is assigned a crime victim advocate who really serves as kind of the liaison and like a case manager throughout their involvement with the project. And what we found is that with the increasing need, we've had to expand how many frontline workers we have. We don't want the crime victim advocates to have so large a caseload that they're not serving everyone well. So really that money will be used to expand crime victim advocate services.
What do these advocates do? What do these case managers do in the process?
So the main thing that they do, the first thing they do is try to interrupt the cycle of violence. Across the country, including in Wisconsin, 50% of interpersonal violence is due to ongoing disagreements, ongoing beef, if you would. The crime victim advocate is really trying to get to that youth and, impart on them that they don't have to continue the cycle of violence. That we know that being shot once is the most likely predictor of you being shot again. We also know that being a victim of interpersonal violence increases your likelihood of becoming a victim again or becoming a perpetrator of violence. And we also know that being shot once decreases your 5-year life expectancy. Right now, firearm injuries are the number one killer of kids. I work in the emergency department, and the number one reason I have to tell a family that their child is dead is because of firearm violence or firearms. It's not cancer. It's not asthma. It's firearms. So anything that our crime victim advocate can do to stop that cycle is saving lives down the road. The next thing that they do is really become a mentor. Mentorship is one of the strongest evidence-based interventions for a variety of social stressors. So the programs across the country that do this kind of work, the main thing they serve is as a mentor, as a trusted adult, positive role model, and then help those youth identify who else in their lives are those positive adult role models. It doesn't necessarily have to be, the traditional role model you think of, but sometimes we help them identify that, hey, there's this teacher that seems to be really invested in you. That can be something you lean into. It might be a coach. It could be a pastor. It could be your aunt. It could be a grandmother. It could be the neighborhood leader, on your block who really is kind of watching out for the youth. So we try to identify that and be mentors as well. And then on top of that, we identify a lot of social needs, right? If there's employment issues in the family, it's hard for a family to be super supportive if they're worried about where rent's coming from, if they're hungry, if there's housing issues. We also advocate in the legal system, right? A lot of times our youth are asked to testify. So we will go to the courts and serve as we will be kind of associates there. And that it runs the gamut. We also have a lot of after school enrichment programming. We do a summer camp as well, where we take about 60 to 80 of the highest risk youth in the summer, which is the most dangerous months in Milwaukee. And we have a summer camp where we let the kids play, and without them realizing we are doing enrichment type programming, positive reinforcement, leadership skills, self-compassion skills, et cetera.
What I'm hearing through all of these layers is that there are people and systems around these survivors who are there and interested and willing to step up and help through this really difficult period in life.
It takes a village, and it takes a lot of invested individuals to really change the trajectory of that youth. I think one of the things that's really important to understand with youth is, one, you know, they're still learning, their brains aren't fully developed. I think the most recent scientific studies, you know, tell us that our brains aren't fully developed till we're 25, right? And we're talking about as young as, you know, we've had participants as young as 7, 8 years old, all the way up through the teens. And these kids are still developing their sense of self, developing their sense of self-worth, and they have dreams, right? They have all these dreams. And once, if they're shot, or if they're physically assaulted, or if they have repeated exposure to homicide, to gun violence, to suicide, a lot of times those dreams, the amount of dreams that they have, compresses. And it takes a lot of investment in terms of time and interest to keep those dreams alive, to keep those dreams open. And the evidence out there is that the more dreams and the more possibilities someone sees in themselves, the less likely they are to make poor choices or get involved with risk-taking behaviors. So really, what I love to tell people who are interested in this work is, even if you don't have the time or don't have the inclination to like change your job career to focus on this, just mentoring one kid can make a huge difference.
We're talking with Dr. Michael Levis, who is a pediatrics professor and medical director for Project Ujima, which is a project in Milwaukee that helps youth victims of violence. Dr. Levis, gun violence in Milwaukee has been trending down in recent years. There have been 118 homicides in Milwaukee this year compared to 31 more at the same time last year. That's from the Milwaukee Police Department. But I understand referrals to Project Ujima this year have outpaced referrals from the 2 years prior. What is happening there?
So it's true. The amount of homicides and fatal gun violence across the country has trended down. I think a lot of that is due to a lot of programs like Project Ujima, a lot of investment from national organizations to really try to stem that the tide of violence. What we have seen, though, is the ages of violently injured youth has shifted downwards. Even though there's less homicides and less volume on the adult side, a lot of your pediatric hospitals across the country are seeing an increase in referrals because it's our youth that are really not seeing that change in incidence of violent injury. The other thing is we don't just see youth who are shot. We see kids who are victims of physical assault as well, because we know that if we look back at youth who are victims of gun violence, there usually has been a pattern of more of risk-taking behavior being in risky situations that lead to that firearm injury. So we try to intervene early. So we don't wait till that firearm injury happens. We will take referrals for, you know, someone who was jumped or someone who got into a fist fight at school. So we are seeing those numbers increase as well. And then we know that there's vicarious trauma. So we don't just take the incident victim. We will see their siblings, because we know that having someone you love either murdered or victim of gun, you know, or non-fatally injured or physically assaulted, that can be scary for your siblings as well. So we do take families. We take, you know, holistics, and sometimes with the incident injury, they don't sign up, but we'll still enroll their sibling because we know that any inroad we have with the family can prevent that next injury, that next tragic event from happening.
Dr. Levis, I wonder though, why are ages of violence and trauma, why is it getting younger?
I think what we've seen is disinvestment in youth. Really, a lot of stuff happened, a lot of the increase with youth being violently injured or being victims of violence coincides with COVID. And what we saw with COVID is that the, you know, most of your urban cities, most of the school districts went virtual. They canceled a lot of their after school programming. They didn't do the sports, and they took longer to come back to being non-virtual. They took longer to reinstate their athletics. They took longer to reinstate their extracurriculars. And I think anytime you do not allow for youth to have pro-social engagement, you run the risk of them engaging in risk-taking behaviors. And then if you have a whole couple of years of that, I think that you have, you know, this series of disinvestment that where the kids are feeling like they have less and less of those options, they have less opportunity, and they make poor choices, and then the cycle continues there.
Looking at the longevity and investment in this work on the project, you've been funded in previous years through several grant sources, U.S. Department of Justice, the National Alliance for Grieving Children. Is this funding enough, or what else do you need?
I think there's a lot of options for us going forward. Of course, we do think that we do rely a lot on federal and state funding, and those grants are very important for us to continue. The hospital system continues to invest, but there are other things out there, other options. The crime victim advocate work, I would argue, is more important than what I do in the emergency department. In the emergency department, the trauma surgery team and the emergency department team, we're really good at saving lives, physical lives, right? We're really good at plugging holes and bringing the body back to a healthy state. What Project Ujima does and other projects like it does is it helps heal the remainder of the story, right? It helps with the mental health. It helps with the well-being, and is probably more impactful longitudinally than what I did in the emergency department. So I would love to see investment. Crime victim advocate work right now in Wisconsin is not reimbursable work, even though I would argue it is healthcare and it is a long-term health investment. There are 7 states in the country that do have Medicaid reimbursement for the work, and a lot of that kind of more stable service-based investment would really help with the longevity of the program, right? It would make us less grant dependent, less philanthropic support dependent. Other things too would just be, I think, if you know the public wants investment into this type of work, that's what they can talk to their legislators about. That this work is important, that this population, that there is something we can do to stem, you know, the number one killer of youth. So just having the public aware of and talking to their legislators about these type of programs and investing in these type of programs could be a big deal.
Dr. Levis, thank you for sharing and thank you for joining us.
Yeah, it was my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
That is Dr. Michael Levis, a professor of pediatrics and associate director of the Comprehensive Injury Center at the Medical College of Wisconsin. He's medical director of Project Ujima at Children's Wisconsin. And for disclosure, Medical College of Wisconsin is a business sponsor of WPR.
You can follow and share important stories like these at our website and on social media. Head over to WPR.org to stream live and play archived audio, and follow us on social media with Facebook channels for Wisconsin Public Radio and WPR Music, Arts, and Culture. And you can get great photo and video stories on Wisconsin Public Radio's Instagram feed. Still ahead, a longtime Wisconsin music promoter shares his career and the challenges of bringing big-name acts to the state.
After being told no two or three times, they finally said, all right, you're really persistent. This better work. And it did, and it was such a memorable show, and everyone had a good time.
That's next here on WPR News.
You're listening to Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Right now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Tyler Ditter with a story about military service.
And it comes as people across the U.S. celebrated Veterans Day earlier this week.
When serving in World War II, Tom Sitter of Madison didn't expect to fight his own countrymen. Though there were tussles with a tank division during his training days, he came to learn that differences were put aside with his fellow soldiers when the going got tough. The following story was told at the Moth during an open mic story slam in Madison, where the theme of the night was karma. As a warning to listeners, the story contains strong language. Here's Tom Sitter live at the Moth.
Thank you. Now, during World War II, I found myself in France. Now, the Battle of the Bulge had started in December of that year and continued through January. We got there, it was pretty much over, but I was in a medical battalion. We carried bodies and prisoners to station hospitals into the aid tents. Now, over there, we ran into our arch enemies, the 9th Armored Division. These guys were all tankers, and they were mean. We had both trained in Kansas near Fort Riley. I was in the cavalry at the time. In 42, they still had horse cavalry down in Fort Riley, in addition to the mechanized cavalry. So when we go into town, the tankers would be in these bars. They'd come, and we'd come walking in, and they'd say, I smell horse shit. The 29th must be here. And we gave as good as we got. As a result, there were a lot of fights going on, a lot of. And first thing they did when we landed in France was to break us up into segments, and they put us with the 1st, the 3rd, and the 9th Army. So we were part of the 9th Army, and up near the Rhine, we were next to the British and Canadian troops. Now, the Rhine River started as a trickle in the Swiss Alps, and when it goes northeasterly, flowing into the North Sea, it becomes a huge river, you know, hundreds of yards across. We noticed when we got up close to the Rhine, we knew we were going to have to cross it, probably in rubber rafts or tiny boats. So we didn't look forward to that. And my rosary got a pretty good workout during that time. By early March, we had good news. Someone had captured a bridge at Remagen. It was a railway trestle bridge, and it was captured by our old arch enemies, the 9th Armored Division. Great guys. We reunited the 20th Armored Division, finally went to the point where we were going to cross. Now, the 9th Armored Division had fought terribly hard to win that. The Germans tried to blow up the trestle bridge, and what happened is some of the charges, for some reason, didn't go off. So the 9th Armored had to go into that trestle, crawling under fire, and to cut wires, remove charges that didn't detonate. At any moment, they thought the thing would go up into their face. And then on top of it, the bridge now was intact, but it was tilted and very shaky. You couldn't get a vehicle across there. So the 9th Armored dismounted, had crawled under fire, went across that bridge one at a time, and they established a bridgehead on the other side of the river. And they held that bridgehead long enough for pontoon bridges to be built where we were. But as we got onto this pontoon, I could tell it was shaking. We were swaying from side to side and dipping and everything else. And we knew that if we made one mistake, that ambulance was going to go into the water. Well, we finally got across the bridge. We went over on the other side of the bridge. We united, and we got to Munich, and finally we crossed the river and got into Bavaria. And as we headed towards the Austrian border, May 7th, 1945, the war ended. Now, yesterday was May 7th, 72 years. To this day, I'm here telling that story because I wouldn't be here had it not been for those incredible bravery of those glorious bastards, the 9th Armored Division.
That was Tom Sitter from Madison at an open mic moth story slam in Madison. You can hear the full story and find more information at wisconsinlife.org. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook and Instagram. I'm Tyler Jitter.
It's Wisconsin Today. That's Stonehenge by the semi-fictional band Spinal Tap, and it played a key role in Wisconsin music history.
It inspired real-life music promoter and club owner Peter Jest of Milwaukee in one of the biggest decisions of his decades-long career.
Peter's been a music promoter in the Milwaukee area and around Wisconsin for over 40 years. He owns the live music venue Shank Hall on the city's east side.
His lifetime of behind-the-scenes stories is documented in a new biography he co-wrote with Amy Waldman.
The book is called We Had Fun and Nobody Died, Adventures of a Milwaukee Music Promoter. Peter, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thanks for having me.
Now, Peter, sometimes I think people go into, you know, running a club, being a promoter or whatever, because they want to live the rock and roll lifestyle and hobnob with musicians. Reading this book, I get the feeling like you went into live music because you really love live music. Can you talk about just your appreciation for seeing musicians play live?
Yeah, I just got the bug when I was in high school, actually maybe eighth grade, of really enjoying music. And the first concert I went to was Bob Seger. And I thought, wow, this is really great. I want to somehow be involved in this industry. And that's what happened.
Now, what were some of your first steps in getting involved in booking shows, bringing acts into Milwaukee?
Well, I worked for a promoter, Steve Mandelman, as like a runner for a couple months, and they went out of business. And then I was at UWM and thought this would be a great place for concerts. And they didn't want to do national bands at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. So I was so frustrated, I started my own student group called the Alternative Concert Group and started bringing in acts then.
And you stayed as a student sort of for a long time. You would audit a bowling class or something like that just to keep your student status, right? So you could keep booking shows?
Yeah, technically. I actually did find out, and I'm actually, because I went to UWM, I'm actually an alumni, but I went there for 7 years and had 24 credits. with a 1.7 grade point, flunking economics and other classes, but I went to bowling and weather maps and underground caves. So that's just to stay in school to promote concerts.
Now, you tried another part of the music business with local legends, the Violent Femmes. You went on tour with them. You were their tour staff for a while. Talk about that experience and why that wasn't the road you wanted to pursue.
Well, it was just, I had promoted them a couple times, and the Violent Femmes liked to have Milwaukee people on the road with them back in the mid-80s or early 80s, the sound man, the light man, the road crew, and they liked me and said, let's give them a chance, because our normal tour manager couldn't do it. And for 2 months, I was on the road with them, and I had never been to New York or Los Angeles or anywhere, and it was quite the experience. But I just sort of found out I'm somewhere of a homebody and like to be at home and promote concerts, locally.
You also try to get a lot of, you know, these aren't at the top of the charts type bands, or at least not yet. What were some of the ones that you hit on and got into a mid-sized venue before they broke and got really big?
Oh, for Shane Call, I mean, I had Alanis Morissette, No Doubt, Sarah McLachlan, Jewel, Goo Goo Dolls, Widespread Panic, all play Shank Hall on the first time. And then I did the first three dates in Milwaukee, Ames, Iowa, and Madison of Pearl Jam, the Smashing Pumpkins, and the Red Hot Chili Peppers, which is an incredible package. I mean, that's like fills a stadium these days. That was back in like 91 or 92.
We are talking to longtime Milwaukee music promoter Peter Jest, owner and founder of Shank Hall in Milwaukee. New book, co-written by him, We Had Fun and Nobody Died. Peter, let's talk about Shank Hall, because this is a key point in your career. You've been promoting bands, bringing bands into Milwaukee and elsewhere in Wisconsin. A lot of work there. What made you take that step to say, I'm going to open this venue? Not arena size, but a good size venue for bands coming through town.
Well, I knew eventually UWM would find some way to kick me out with my academic record because what I was doing. And Milwaukee needed a club to help develop acts into bigger acts or acts that were big and on the way down or just some acts that play 100 to 300 seats rooms. And the room used to be Teddy's, which was a famous music club in the 70s in Milwaukee, and then became a comedy club. And they went out of business New Year's Eve of 88. And I thought, that's a perfect spot to have a base and build acts to Milwaukee. And hopefully they'll stay with me, when they get bigger. But unfortunately, as soon as I did that, Live Nation came around. And no matter who some people worked with, they paid all the money to get all the big acts later on. But it still was, it's still been a great 35 years. And a lot of bands really enjoy playing there and fans. So it's really gone well.
Let's talk about the name of Shank Hall. There's a story behind it that I didn't know until I read the book. It's a case of life imitating art. Where did you get the name?
Oh, yeah. We took it from the movie Spinal Tap. When they played five fictional cities, like Fidelity Hall in Philadelphia. But they had a Milwaukee. It was called Shank Hall, Milwaukee. And I told my friend, gee, if I ever open a music club, I got to call it Shank Hall, because all the musicians will get it. It's like an in-joke. And it really worked really well. In fact, the guys really got a kick that I took a five-second bit out of their movie and named a club after it. Michael McKean, if you look at the book, does a blurb on the back. He took time to read it and really loved the story and got a kick that I named it Shank Hall.
You talk in the book about relations you formed with some performers who you worked with over the years. And actually one I saw in Madison, I assume it's a show that you booked, Arlo Guthrie. It was an amazing show, and you almost became an honorary Guthrie, it sounds like. Can you talk about that relationship over the years?
Yeah, Arlo was very special. In fact, me and my wife were going to New Hampshire for a relative's graduation. And I said, Arlo, do you mind if we stop by and say hello? And he said, not only that, come by and spend the night. So we just visited Arlo a couple months ago, because since he retired from touring, I had to go visit him since he doesn't come this way. But it started out just doing a few shows and then taking him to all these cities across Wisconsin. Like Oshkosh, Stevens Point, Wausau, Door County, La Crosse, Eau Claire, Madison. And, you know, just being with him a while, we got along. His kids were there, which were about my age. And, yeah, we just became friends and got along and socialized after the shows. And it's a very special thing. And in the book, it says he thanked me on stage. And Sara Lee Guthrie, his daughter, is next to me. And I looked really surprised. And she goes, "What are you surprised for? You're like family to us. You're like a Guthrie." And that really stuck with me. And it was a very special moment.
Let's talk about the industry today. And you touched on this. Live Nation, Ticketmaster, if they're not monopolies, they're, you know, on the way. How has that changed, you know, people's access to see live shows in Wisconsin?
Yeah, it's really has. I mean, there used to be personal relationships with acts. You'd have promoters that, you know, would have a territory and the acts would come and that'd be your act. I mean, like Arlo Guthrie or John Prine. These days, you know, Live Nation just sort of bought all the regional promoters. Then they merged with Ticketmaster. And so they really have almost a monopoly on the business, especially on big acts. And they can pay acts so much money, you know, and they don't really care about making money on the show because they have a, you know, $40 service charge, $30 parking, $20 beer. They get enough people. That's where they make their money. And it's really just become a suit and tie corporate business for Live Nation and, you know, for all these acts. It's just about money and making money for the stockholders. So it's taken a lot of the entrepreneurship, you know, that started in the late 60s and the 70s, you know, out of the business.
Now, people are listening around the state. Can you leave us with some encouragement, Peter, to go check out some live music, maybe at that little club, you know, downtown or whatever, wherever they might be?
Yeah, I mean, I know a lot of people like to see music in the summer because, you know, we only can be out of our houses for 3 months in Wisconsin, but there is a lot of nice places indoors during the fall, winter, and spring. Plus, like I said, a lot of nice theaters all over the state that do, not that I only do shows at, but other people do, and the venues do a lot of shows at a lot of, just go out and support them because that's how to keep live music and entertainment going.
Peter, thanks a lot for sharing your story with us.
Oh, thank you for having me.
That's Peter Jest, Milwaukee music promoter who owns the music venue Shank Hall. He was with us to share stories from the new biography. He co-wrote it with Amy Waldman. It's called We Had Fun and Nobody Died, Adventures of a Milwaukee Music Promoter. If you have a favorite local music venue that you like to go to or maybe play at if you're a musician yourself, tell us about it. Email wisconsintoday@wpr.org. That's wisconsintoday@wpr.org.
Future program, we'll find out about UW Oshkosh establishing its first women's wrestling program. At the collegiate level, the NCAA classifies women's wrestling as an emerging sport.
Then at the high school level, girls wrestling has become the fastest growing sport in the country.
And we want to hear from you. Did you participate in a pioneering sport in women's athletics? What was that experience like? How do you view the sport now? And what do you think the future holds for women wrestlers here in Wisconsin?
Be part of the conversation about wrestling and women's sports, and we might share it in a future segment. Call or text us at 888-642-0232. That's 888-642-0232. Or you could email wisconsintoday@wpr.org. That's wisconsintoday@wpr.org. And thanks for sharing your perspective.
Wisconsin Today is the work of a team of producers, hosts, and technical directors. Learn more about us at wpr.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to WPR News.